On Robinhood Radio, it's time for the Media Beat from David Tereshchuk, his weekly review of media coverage. David is a multimedia journalist with an online column at themediabeat.com and has reported since 2012 for the PBS network, mainly on ethical issues. He is also the author of a memoir, A Question of Paternity, Life as an Unaffiliated Reporter. Here's David.
This is David Tereshchuk with the Media Beat for the weekend beginning October 18th, 2024. Generally speaking, I've never been very fond of hypotheticals. They've always, to me, smacked too much of sheer speculation. And speculative journalism has always struck me as the very opposite of good journalism. And good journalism is founded, we might agree, on copper-bottomed, iron-clad facts. Detective Joe Friday from Radio and TV's Ancient Dragnet series serves in my mind as a mythical stand-in for the gold standard journalist, in that he would say, emblematically, "Just give me the facts, ma'am, just the facts." But asking hypothetical questions about the road ahead can obviously still have a useful purpose, most of all that of helping us prepare for likely or even unlikely unexpected turns that forthcoming events might take. That's, of course, especially true in the matter of national elections, like the one currently looming just 18 days from now. So let's consider some salient what-ifs that have been inspiring speculative journalism of the better, more useful sort. One concerns the election at commander-in-chief level, and another centres more on the level we can call boots on the ground. The top-level what-if is this. 3 weeks after the election, Donald Trump is scheduled to appear before a judge here in Manhattan. Specifically, it's Justice Juan Merchan, a justice of the New York State Supreme Court, who you'll remember presided over the trial that lasted through April and May and ended with Trump being found guilty on 34 felony counts. It's to be a sentencing hearing. How likely is it that Trump will be given jail time? It's not a fanciful question. Over the past 10 years in Manhattan, being convicted of such felonies, in particular that of falsifying business records, like Trump did, has led to the felon spending time behind bars in more than a third of all such cases. Across New York State as a whole, the proportion has been substantially higher. About 42% of those convictions meant that the guilty individual had to go to jail or to prison. In this unique case of a former president as a convicted man, Justice Merchan will have had a report or recommendation made to him based on a New York City probation officer's interview with that convicted man. The interview took place, incidentally, via video conference call, not a concession normally given to guilty offenders. The officer was in Manhattan. Trump and one of his lawyers were at Mar-a-Lago in Florida. Again, it's unusual for counsel to be present for such interviews. As the judge ponders that probation report and all the other factors, he has a range of choices open to him. For a felony of the Class E kind, which is what falsifying business records is, specifically Trump's attempts to disguise the hush money paid to Stormy Daniels, the porn star, he could impose up to 4 years behind bars. If it's any time over 1 year, Trump would serve it in a full-fledged prison. If it's less than a year, the normal thing would be to serve it in one of our city jails. It could be a lesser sentence, of course, maybe just probation, or even, and this could create an interesting stir, a period of community service. The individual judge's discretion is considerable. So we do have to recall that the same individual judge has a sentencing record that is far from sympathetic to white-collar criminals in general. We owe a debt to some thorough delving by our hometown newspaper, The New York Times, on this matter. The paper has quoted a 2018 judgment by Justice Merchan against a fraudster whom he sent to prison for a minimum of 7 years, saying that white-collar criminals have, quote, too often and for too long received unfairly gentle treatment in the criminal justice system compared with other kinds of criminal. Oh, and more recently, Justice Merchan was the judge who sent Trump's own chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, to jail, albeit for only 5 months, the result of a plea deal on his tax fraud charges. During the course of that trial, Merjan again said he did not believe white-collar criminals deserved any special treatment or light sentences. But most pertinent of all might be Justice Merjan's own conduct of the current case at hand. As the trial phase proceeded 5 months ago, Trump memorably violated a gag order imposed on him, violated it 10 times over, committing contempt of court, of course. He went on social media and attacked the justice himself and his family, attacks that seemed to fuel death threats that were made against his daughter, who happens to be a political consultant for the Democratic Party. Trump's striking display of literally contemptuous behavior led to $10,000 being levied against him in fines, and Merjan also, and this is certainly worth noting, threatened even back then to throw Trump in jail if his violations continued. And of course they stopped. So the crunch what-if could be this. What will happen if Trump is given a custodial sentence? Would officers of the court, or as often happens in Manhattan, the New York Police Department, be obliged to carry out his incarceration by force? Or can we see Trump willingly surrendering to them? The scenario could turn distinctly nasty. Thoughts inevitably turn to the so-called Proud Boys, or what's left of them after the imprisoning of their leaders for their role on January the 6th in the Capitol riot. They could well show up in order to, in their terms, defend Trump and help him resist. None of these hypotheticals are yet being considered widely in the mainstream press, not even the definitely deeply interested New York Times. But the Reuters news agency, which has been doing a good job monitoring the predictable regrouping of the Proud Boys, did quote the federal prosecutor Connor Mulroe, saying that these militants, and I quote, see themselves as Donald Trump's army, fighting to keep their preferred leader in power no matter what the law or the courts have to say about it. But such violent possibilities could all be rendered entirely moot by a much bigger, more overarching what-if. What if Trump wins the election? As president-elect, he'd be rushing with his flanking lawyers, who've already achieved the postponement of this sentencing date until after the election, to demand an indefinite delay. And indeed, a Trump victory would probably short-circuit any sentencing at all, according to many legal authorities, and that's despite this matter being a state case and Trump plus any new Trumpian attorney general would strictly have authority only over federal cases. All of those, the outstanding federal cases against Trump, would simply be dropped. We can be sure of that. Let's look at another what-if story. I mentioned boots on the ground earlier, and it's an almost literally true label for what's involved here. Military veterans are signing up in their considerable numbers, already 160,000 of them and more coming along, to perform a rather different kind of role in service to the nation. There's a reporter at NPR named Quill Lawrence who has parlayed his previous very creditable war reporting in Iraq and Afghanistan into now specializing in veterans affairs, pretty well a unique assignment across American news organizations. And he's charted a new movement called Vet the Vote. Army veterans, and others from different branches of our armed forces, some long retired, others who've served abroad more recently, are signing up now as poll workers. One more recent retiree, Matthew McGarry, told Lawrence this seemed like an appropriate way to continue service. And he described his purpose this way. Making sure we'll have continued faith in the results of these elections is one of the most important things we can do. You might recall I recently devoted an edition of the Media Beat to the various very serious physical threats being made against election workers. So it was heartening to hear Lawrence's report. The implicit what-if in the story lies in what might happen if there is trouble over the vote on election day itself, or the count that night, or over successive days. This time, at least, we will see seasoned, even maybe some battle-hardened veterans doing their public duty in the electoral process, and maybe they'll be better prepared for trouble than more conventional election workers. But, and there is always a but in political stories ahead of an election, yet another what-if, a decidedly contrary what-if, came this week out of the very mouth of one principal contender in the race that's supposed to finish on November 5th. Yes, Trump himself again. Fox News used to be his favourite network, and he now barely tolerates it, though it still appears safer terrain for him than CBS, where he broke with a 50-year tradition, almost a constitutional obligation, and refused to appear and sit down for a pre-election set piece with the 60 Minutes program. Anyway, Fox News, in the shape of host Maria Bartiromo, put a hypothetical to him about what she called chaos on election day being caused by agitators. Trump's answer is now logged as yet more evidence he's slavishly using the playbook typical of tin-pot dictators all around the world. He imported a mantra from his rallies and talked of the enemy from within, describing them, shall we say, colourfully as sick people, radical left lunatics. But of course he also wanted to reassure us, like many a big man autocrat, reassure us that, quote, I think it should be very easily handled by, if necessary, the National Guard, or if really necessary, by the military. Hypothetical it may be, but it certainly helps to crystallize the choice before us in 18 days' time. That's all from the Media Beat this week. If you have been, thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, David. We will talk to you next week. David can be found at themediabeat.us.